This is Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Eric Thiel. Welcome to another live session. Today, I am joined in the studio by one of the most amazing guitarists I and perhaps you have ever heard. Mr. Adrian Legg is my guest.
I blush.
Welcome to Jefferson Public Radio.
It's a great pleasure.
Thank you so much for stopping.
Great pleasure.
AdrianLegg.com is the website. The newest record, which is something like number 18, kind of depends on the source you look at, because there were a couple that you released very early on, before your first American release.
Yes.
It's called Dead Bankers.
Yes.
I want to circle back around to that name in just a bit.
Okay.
You know, over the years, as I just mentioned, something like 18 records, you have put out quite a bit of music, but as I understand it, you're not a big fan of recording.
No, I hate it.
Why?
Music is a live form. We come together to share it, to share our emotional experiences. That's what music's for. Putting in little packets just commodified it and ruined it. It led inevitably to what's going on now.
Are there not recordings that you own?
Yes,
and
course.
Are a huge fan of and like to listen to over and over?
Yes, of course. I know. You know, there's the hard and fast thing, then it's the practical one. I mean, I've got lots of orchestral recordings that I love to bits, but I could never afford to go and hear the orchestras. So, you know, I realise there's two sides to it. But by and large, it's the commodification of music, which has not happened so much in classical music, which is my thing. I'm square as they come, you know. So in classical music, I'm still getting good stuff, and it's not particularly commodified. But in our side of music, the folk stroke non-academic side, it's been commodified to hell and back and is now trashed, which is inevitable with commodification. That's how it works.
How long have you been playing guitar now?
Well, on and off for since I was probably about 13 or 14, but I never got anywhere with it.
I want to talk a little bit about that off period. You mentioned on and off. There have been a couple of periods where you have not really played much, correct?
Well, yeah, you got to pay the rent, you know.
And at that time it wasn't, I'm guessing.
That's playing. Right, yeah.
You worked early on as a repair technician.
Yes, that was about 78 to 83, thereabouts.
What did you learn doing that kind of work that educated your own work designing the instruments that you use now?
The way the guitar worked for me, I played electric in pub bands and cover bands and things, and I made a decent living most of the time doing that and thoroughly enjoyed it. Then I started writing on the guitar, and that had to be acoustic because the acoustic has a harmonic structure that supports itself. It works solo. An electric guitar doesn't necessarily do that. It has a thinner harmonic content, and it's much more of an in-band instrument. So the two things were running along side by side. I was doing the pub gigs and the bands on one side, and then on the other side, I'd actually got some broadcasting work with the acoustic for the BBC. I found it virtually impossible then to take the acoustic out on stage and get a sound that I wasn't thoroughly embarrassed by.
Mm.
And gradually that changed. But I got to a point where I was just sick of the whole thing. And I was tired of the pubs, I was tired of the bands, I was tired of trying to get a sound out of an acoustic. So I thought, well, I'll go into the industry. And I went into the industry as a tech. And that was accidental because somebody asked me to do some clinics for them to demonstrate their products. And I said, fine, send me the guitars first. And he said, why? I said, I want to set them up. And he said, what's that? I said, well, when they come off the wall, you can't play them. You have to set them up so that you can play them. And he didn't understand that. And so at that point, I said, well, I did those guitars and I took them to a clinic. And he said, these guitars feel fantastic. I said, yes, all your guitars should feel like that. The first thing that happens is somebody sees them on a wall and thinks, oh, lovely. Second thing is they get them down the field and it's ugh. So I said, your guitars should all feel nice. And so I got a job making them all feel nice, and that gradually extended into more technical, more geeky things. So I was doing artist guitars, I was doing design, I was doing all kinds of stuff, and it was great fun.
It seems like in reading interviews that you have done over the last 20, 30 years that you are on a lifelong search for the perfect mix of electric and acoustic
blending.
Yeah, that's
pretty much it, yeah.
Have you?
It's the guitar. I mean, it goes back a long way. For me, I don't differentiate between Lonnie Mack and Elizabeth Cotton, for instance. For me, that came to me across the Atlantic a long time ago as the American guitar. And the American guitar is a very distinct instrument. It didn't happen anywhere else. It's the steel string. It happened here. The dreadnoughts happened here. It was electrified here. All the development in the guitar happened in America in response to the needs of American musicians. It's a huge part of American culture, very, very strong part of your culture. And I just saw the whole thing. And I wanted the whole thing, not just Elizabeth Cotton, not just the folky stuff, not just the rock stuff, but all of it.
You seem to be very obsessed, focused, I don't know the right word to put in there, with with gear, with the technology that supports playing the guitar.
Yes, because it's never quite right.
Does that focus or that interest and depth of knowledge ever get in the way of just...
No.
Just playing.
It serves tone. The idea is to have a sound that works and that produces an emotional reaction in somebody else. People don't understand when they hear music that doesn't work for them. They don't understand the technical bit that was wrong that meant it didn't work. They just understand that they heard something that didn't move them. What I want to do as a musician is to consistently produce something that moves them. And in order to do that, I have to fiddle around with this wretched stuff and get it to sound like I want it to sound.
Adrian Legg is my guest live today on Jefferson Public Radio. His newest record is called Dead Bankers. Information on him, his music, even some samples of his music, online at adrianlegg.com, spelled with two G's, by the way. Will you play us something?
Yes, this is the piece I always start with. I have tried not starting with it and things have gone wrong, so I just start with it every time, and I hope people aren't sick of it yet. It's called Midwest Sunday.
Thank you.
That is Adrian Legg, live on Jefferson Public Radio. His newest record, number 18 or so,
I really don't know. It's called
Dead Bankers. What do you enjoy more? Do you enjoy making music or crafting sound?
Making music every time, playing live. It's perfect. It's the whole raison d'etre.
Even though just before the tune, you talked at length about finding that perfect tone, that perfect sound.
Yes, but you get the perfect sound in order to play live and try to communicate with people then. That's the whole purpose of it. It's nothing else. It's to be able to make something happen in somebody else's head.
Well, and your interface, of course, is a guitar. For many, many years, every photograph of you was holding an Ovation guitar.
Yes.
Probably the most famous Ovation that most people know is the one that Melissa Etheridge holds. She's always prominently holding that big black one. Mm-hmm. You used an Ovation for 20 years, something like that?
Because of the pickup.
Because of the pickup in it?
Yes. The problem with... how geeky do you want to get? This can get terribly geeky. There is a problem with amplifying acoustics. It's an oxymoronic concept right away. You can't amplify an acoustic. Acoustic means without amplification. However, we bodge by, and you can put bugs on acoustics. You can put mics in front of them. You've lost the instrument by that time. You've lost it. But you can get something that represents it. You can get a facsimile. And one of the facsimiles that worked quite well was to put a pickup under the bridge saddle so that you got as close to the strings as possible and eliminated body feedback. Those things were always pressure sensitive. So if you change the pressure of the strings on the saddle, your balance, string balance went to hell in a handbasket and the whole thing went wrong. You got weird sounds, you got nasty sounds and all kinds. The Ovation pickup didn't do that. It sat its piezo crystals inside an aluminium trough and they put a kind of roof over it. So it was sensitive to vibration but not sensitive to pressure. And that was really what opened up this direction for me, that business of being sensitive to vibration but not to string pressure. Mm. So you could string it how you liked, you could do what the hell you like, change the tuning, the pickup delivered the same sound all the time. So it was a magnificent pickup. The rest of the guitar we may debate. It did function quite well. The roundback thing did record very well. I first noticed that with a BBC session where I had to do a rhythm guitar track for somebody, and I'd forgotten to take my Martin into work. And so I went from work with one of their guitars, and the engineer was really pleased. He said, "Oh, great." And he stuck a mic in front of it, and that big plastic roundback threw the sound directly at the mic, and it recorded clean as a whistle. So there were aspects of those guitars you may debate. Some people really hate them. Some people love them. For me, they were functional. It wasn't a love or a hate. They worked. That was it. They did the job I wanted.
You have a fascinating guitar now. Tell me a little bit about how you came to own this and what it is exactly, because there are lots of unusual things about it.
Yes, it's the result of my 40 years of geekery and Bill's 40 years of geekery. So a total of about 80 years of geekery.
And Bill is?
Bill is an old friend of mine that I met when I was teching. And there were several of us that were on the phone every day with these dealing with these under-saddle problems and with the latest solution, the latest fix, or the latest nightmare, and what are we going to do about this? So we were on the phone every day. And I got to know Bill, and he's been a good pal ever since. And I needed a guitar that sat more diagonally. If you look at a guitar player sitting with an acoustic, the left shoulder's always down, right shoulder's up. That means the spine is twisted, it's under tension, and from that tension flow all the injuries that guitar players get. Straighten out your spine and you fix most of your RSIs right away. And that's what we tried to do.
And it's also somewhat limited in size due to some flying requirements?
Well, yeah. The Boeing 777 came into service on the transatlantic run, and nobody would say how big the overhead was. Nobody would say. Every time I spoke to any of them, they said, "Oh, it's great. You won't bang your head on it." I said, "Yeah, but how long is it?" "No, oh, it's fine. You won't bang your head on it." You know? So the first one I got on, they were very kind to us, and I went on with a full-length, full-size guitar on a Damas, and they very kindly put it in the business class closet and everything. And they were being terribly nice to us because they didn't want us to look out the windows and count the engines. There are only two. So you look out the engine, you go, one, miss, there's only one engine. So they were introducing a twin to fly transatlantic, so they were pretty kind to us. But the first thing I did was then get up and measure the overhead. And it was 37 and a half inches long. So my guitar is 36 and a half inches long. First rule of air travel is thou shalt not hack off, miss. And if she sees you struggling to get your guitar in the overhead, there's a good chance it's going to get checked and crushed, and you're going to get bits back at the far end of the journey.
The other feature, well, there are two that I want to ask you specifically about. One is this sort of unusual side-located sound hole. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
It projects it in it toward you, actually, as you're holding it.
The whole point of that body structure, everything in it is about vibration transmission and retention. I can get geeky again. You better stop me if it goes off weird.
Well, we'll have a picture of it up on our website.
The center section is hollow. There's a box section forward of the bridge that's very important. I got to dodge a geeky thing there. There's a box section. It's important. Take it from me. It needed porting because there was a cavity. We built it first unported with a cavity, and you tune a cavity by porting it or not porting it. That's how you put the top on the bottom. You hold a tube, close one end and blow, you'll get one note. Take your hand away, you'll get another note. We needed to change the internal resonance, which was very, very close to concert pitch A already. Just by a sheer freak of luck, we got this thing beautifully pitched, you know. And so we ported it because it wasn't quite right. The resonance wasn't quite right. We ported it and it sounded good. And then I felt that it needed flaring because I felt the treble needed opening out. Now, this all sounds very weird and odd. Just the idea of physically opening out part of a guitar should actually open out the sound of the treble. But it worked. It opened out the treble. And the whole point of the cavity, the port, and everything that goes on in that guitar is to deliver a quality of signal. It's not to make an acoustic sound. It's to deliver a quality of signal to the pickup that will go down the line and come out the far end of all the speakers and gubbins and sound harmonically the way I want it to sound. So that's what it was all about.
And there is one other feature on your guitar that features very prominently in most of the videos of you on the internet.
Yeah.
And no doubt anybody that heard you play that first tune is wondering to a degree how in the world you did it.
You don't know your own culture.
So you have your tuning pegs are a little unusual.
Yeah.
You don't find them on most guitars. What are they exactly? Did you help develop
pegs.
Them? And how do they work? I mean, they obviously work wonderfully in your hands. But...
All your listeners should look up Bill Keith. He's a massive figure in your culture and highly undersung. He changed the banjo. When he worked with Bill Munro, he developed a melodic right hand. Instead of all the clanging and banging that used to go on in bluegrass with the note somewhere in the middle on the left hand, he developed a system whereby he could set up shapes in the left hand and then pick out a melodic flow with his right. The man is a genius, but he's also a great engineer. And people before Scruggs were using extra cams shoved onto their banjos to push against the string and change the pitch of the note. Bill developed a system, Bill Keith, not my Bill, Bill Keith developed a system whereby top and bottom stops were contained within the peg. It's a brilliant piece of engineering. And banjo players know all about it. Guitar players know nothing about it. I'd say to guitar players, you're playing a plucked string instrument. Look around you at all the other plucked string instruments and see what you can take from them and bring to the guitar and maybe do something nicer with the guitar. They already stuck great big waggly things on, dive bombing, you know. Look at the other end, you know, and look at the stringed instruments around you. Learn from them. And, you know, talk to banjo players. They're lonely. They'll tell you everything.
Adrian Legg is my guest live today on Jefferson Public Radio. His newest release is called Dead Bankers. Will you play something else?
Yes, something raucous. I think I mentioned already my influences would be from Lonnie Mack to Elizabeth Cotton. And so I'd like something a bit grubbier from the Lonnie Mack side of life, as it were. And this one's called Toot Toot. We'll be right back.
It's Adrian Legg live on Jefferson Public Radio. His newest release is called Dead Bankers. You can get information on the album and on Adrian at his website, adrianlegg2gs.com. I have read that you are a fairly voracious listener of music. Is that still true?
Well, the opposite, actually. I tend to ignore a lot of it, but I listen to... I'm very, very square. I listen to a lot of classical music now. I was brought up on it and then avoided it like the plague as soon as I got away from home. Now I find myself coming back to it. So I listen to big chunks of big music and then stop.
Late Romantic stuff? I mean, when you mentioned big music...
From Bach to Brahms,
okay.
Really.
Yeah.
I skipped the classical period. I'm not too keen on that. I'm beginning to tolerate Mozart in small doses. I love Beethoven because he was a nice bloke, but the music is kind of a bit circular for me.
I want to transition a little bit away from music because one of your albums, going back a number of years, is called High Strung Tall Tales.
Yes.
Tall Tales have always been a big part of your live performance, yes?
It was accidental, really.
Why? Did you break a string or need to retune or something?
Well, there was an incident where that happened, and I read the tribe, Joe's tribe in Ordnance, I read them a poem about a dead cat while a roadie fixed my guitar. But that was by the by. They were very puzzled, but they took it in good spirit and didn't throw anything. When I first came over here, I was keen that I should play the guitar. It seemed to me that I should not yammer on. But a couple of people said they really like to hear you talk. And I said, is it because I sound funny? They said, well, probably, but give it a go anyway. And I found it was getting quite conversational after a while. And I just told stupid stories. And I just enjoy it. Mm. It's a sociable thing, music. You know, it really is very much a social thing. This business of coming together and sharing our emotional experiences. We can share a few stories as well, you know. And as the tours go on and I get less and less practice, of course, I tell more stories because I probably can't play the next piece.
We were talking before we went on the air today that my first exposure to you was as a young guy working in public radio at a station, running the control board during All Things Considered and hearing commentaries from none other than Adrian Legg.
Yes.
You did that for off and on about a decade or so, didn't you?
I don't remember how long it actually ran for. It was fairly intermittent.
Did they approach you or did you submit to them? How did that work?
The first time it happened, I was on my way down to Florida and they said, can you stop by in DC and do a radio interview? I said, oh, come on, I got a car full of gear. You want me to park it somewhere in D.C.? And I was very against the whole idea. And they persuaded me, and they said, there'll be somewhere for you to park it. So I said, okay, as long as it's secure, great, I'll pop in on the way and do it. And it was Bob, and it was just a great interview. I really enjoyed it. It felt very homely. The whole NPR thing was really... It wasn't like that in-your-face tarty radio. It was just like proper talking to people radio, and I really enjoyed it. So they did the interview, and the record sales, that when that went out, tripled. And the record company were absolutely astonished. They said, oh, God, it's going to be a hit. So they immediately put them in all the tower listening posts and paid a fortune to do it, and nothing changed. From which we learned... that we need to talk to intelligent people who listen to public radio and not the idiots who go in the record stores. And after that, I suppose Bob, I think somebody at Relativity in LA was in touch with Bob.
And that was your record company at the time.
Yes. And that, it kind of grew from there. I'm not sure how. I think Bob liked the idea. And he was very helpful. His guidance was really good. It was very difficult for me at first writing. I'd always written for magazines. So I was writing, I'd write for word length for reading. And I had to learn to write for time. And that was interesting. So I'd write things and I'd sit at home reading them out loud with all the neighbors wondering what was going on.
Let's talk briefly about your new record.
Mm.
Why did you call it Dead Bankers?
I wanted something that everybody would like.
Was there a particular story that came to you when crafting the title?
Yes. The whole banking thing lately has been such an appalling scam. really a bunch of gangsters swindling the lot of us. It's been absolutely appalling. They created the whole slum. It was gambling and casino banking. It was just absolutely appalling. But if you look back to the Medicis, Lorenzo de' Medici was a phenomenal chap. He sponsored Leonardo da Vinci and was heavily involved in financing the Italian Renaissance. So once upon a time, bankers did do good, and they contributed something to society that was really valuable. Now, okay, you can say, well, the art of the time was the way you did PR, but it lasted, and we still have this fabulous art as the result of the Medici family, and specifically Lorenzo, who was called Lorenzo the Magnificent, putting so much into it. And they gave us Leonardo da Vinci. You know, without the Medicis, Leonardo would not have produced so much work. So they kept him afloat. So that was a really priceless thing. So there's two sides to it. There's the dead bankers, yeah, I wish they all were. And then there's this dead banker who was really good. Now, why can't our bankers do something as creative as that with all this wealth they're amassing?
Adrian Legg is my guest live today in the JPR studios. As I mentioned, we'll have audio and a few photos of our live session today up on our website later today, www.ijpr.org. His newest record is Dead Bankers. You can learn more about Adrian Legg's playing, his music, his opinions at his website.
Oh, there's lots of them.
AdrianLegg.com, L-E-G-G.com. Mr. Legg, it has been a joy to have you in.
Oh, it's a great pleasure.
Thank you for visiting with us. Will you play us one more?
Yes. Let me see now. This one, I used to do a lot of steel licks and things in bands, and I really like doing it. I like the sound of the steel guitar. It's another big influence, those pedal changes and things. So it's like what I said before, you know, go and listen to other plucked instruments, see what you can steal and bring back. And this one is called the Doorbell Song, because in the middle of it there was a ding-dong, which was like the old Avon calling ad. You remember that? Ding-dong,
yes.
Avon calling. I couldn't get rid of it. I was trying to get rid of it. I heard it when I first started writing it. And in the end, I left it in and called it the Doorbell Song.
That is Adrian Legg, live here on Jefferson Public Radio. His website again, adrianlegg.com. The newest record is called Dead Bankers. Adrian Legg, thanks again for coming by and visiting with us.
My pleasure. Great pleasure, Eric. Thank you.